Malicious malpractice. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon. Revelation. From the beginning, Mrs. Glover's partnership with Kennedy was a financial success. At the end of their first year, after first deducting all expenses such as rent, etc., her share of the receipts was $1,744. But her main interest was in the work, not the money. Kennedy was a popular young doctor, busy constantly. Many other students were beginning to practice in a small way with good success. Two students, Mrs. Spofford and Wallace Wright, were practicing full-time in Knoxville, Tennessee, with very good success. The summer season had arrived, and New Englanders were thinking of vacation trips. In a letter to a student, Mrs. Glover remarked casually, "Yesterday morning, Richard took a fit to go to Portland." His purpose for such a trip did not dawn on her at this time. She made a trip to Tilton for a visit, but wrote from there on July 11th, "They were glad to see me on my arrival. But really, all is so changed since I were here that I feel as if I never wanted to come again." Mary's heart was in her work and with her students. What Richard Kennedy learned about Quimby and mesmerism while in Portland is conjectural, but the results of his clandestine malpractice began to appear startlingly in Mrs. Glover's experience. It was some time before she traced this wickedness to its source, and even when she did, she could scarcely credit it. With her spiritual insight and unusual abilities, why did she not see it sooner? In Exposing Kennedy, in the third edition of Science and Health, she gives two reasons for the fact that he was able to deceive her as long as he did. Carefully veiling his character through unsurpassed secretiveness, he wore the mask of innocence and youth. We have never departed from one cardinal point of metaphysics, namely, never to encroach on the rights of mind, never to enter another's thoughts more unceremoniously than his dwelling, to read mind only when it appeals to you for help. Until now, all her students had appealed to her for help, and she read their thoughts as easily as she heard their words. They were anxious to be healed, and she never failed to heal them. Or they sought her help with difficult cases, and again she never failed to heal. But strange things began to occur. One morning Mrs. Glover fell downstairs, and Kennedy carried her up, bleeding and unconscious. The young girl who lived on the third floor of the same house was sent to get Samuel Bancroft, who came immediately and treated as he had learned to do from his teacher. In a short time, she was up and around and came to the supper table. Occupants of all three floors had made arrangements for meals together, as usual. It had become proverbial that friends and patients were benefited and often cured just by Mrs. Glover's presence or by talking with her. Then, one day, one of her best friends said, "I hope you will excuse me, but I cannot see you. I suffer so in your presence." This friend had always proclaimed that she felt better in Mrs. Glover's presence. In Mary's words, "We were pained at the change and her altered manner, and insisted on her telling us what was our offense." She replied, "In the many years I have known you, I was never cognizant of your doing wrong, but you make me suffer now, and I do not love you as I did. We parted in mystery, and our lives have ever since floated apart down the river of years. We could not beg the friendship we hoped to deserve, and never knew until long afterwards the silent influence by which that student, whom we were benefiting daily, severed our friendship. But no experience leaves us where it found us. And because of such sore trials, Mrs. Eddy could instruct the children of Earth, "Would existence without personal friends be to you a blank? Then the time will come when you will be solitary, left without sympathy. Friends will betray and enemies will slander until the lesson is sufficient to exalt you." The author has experienced the foregoing prophecy and its blessings. Mrs. Glover had expected to hear from Wallace W. Wright soon after he left for the South, and though she had heard reports of his immediate success, nearly 3 months elapsed with no letter from him. When one finally arrived in midsummer, she opened it eagerly and was shocked at its contents. It was an abusive epistle, which said in part, "Restored to myself again, I shall be more willing to overlook in you the pains I have already suffered in bearing the load you have put upon me. I ask you to refund to me this amount, $500, and I will retire from the cause, but still consider that I am not restored to my former position." Wright insinuated in the same letter of August 24th that the relationship between Mrs. Spofford and Dr. Kennedy was improper. Mrs. Glover answered immediately, saying she did not want to hear such gossip, giving him helpful counsel, including the statement, "You are now in a chemical." But her counsel, her love, and her guidance were not effective as they had always been before. A second letter from Wright described graphically what Kennedy's malpractice had accomplished, though neither he nor his teacher had any inkling of the cause at this time. "The chemical you say I am in has been with me most of the time since I took this up, as I am floored in arguments with myself and cannot sustain the positions your manuscripts take. And my conversations with Mrs. S. are far from satisfactory, as the weight of my argument crushes any she is able to bring forward on the side of science." It may have been the weight of Wright's arguments that caused Mrs. Addie Spofford to make a trip to Lynn to see her teacher in the fall. When she returned to Knoxville, she wrote on October 2nd, "When I reached home, I found my practice was much run down. I shall have hard work to bring it up again, but I don't regret my journey, for I gained so much spiritually while with you. Be with us, dear Mrs. Glover, and help us, for I am strangely drawn to this field of labor." Later in the fall, Wright returned to Lynn and called on Mrs. Glover, threatening to ruin the cause of metaphysical healing unless she paid him the $500 he demanded. Kennedy denounced Wright's conduct, but he was not able to hide completely from the thought of his teacher the fact that it pleased him. Her experience with Wallace Wright might well have influenced the poem she wrote on receiving some beautiful grapes, for he had shown beautiful promise in the classroom. And now, how bitter! The poem appeared in the November 4th issue of the Lynn Transcript. Lines on Receiving Some Grapes by Mary Baker Glover. Beautiful grapes, would I were thee, clustering round a parent stem, the blessing of my God to be in woodland, bower, or glen, where friend or foe had never sought the angels born of apes, and breathed the disappointed thought, behold, they are sour grapes. And such, methinks, e'en nature shows the fate of beauty's power, admired in parlor, grotto, groves, but faded, oh, how sour! Worth unlike beauty, fadeless, pure, a blessing and most blessed, beyond the shadows will endure, and give the lone heart rest. The youthful George Berry had first gone to Dr. Kennedy with bleeding lungs, hoping to be cured of consumption. He had regained perfect health after instruction from Mrs. Glover, and was most enthusiastic about moral science. Berry was naive, and Richard Kennedy remarked to his teacher, "Berry is a fool, and you will find how you will come out with him." But Richard maintained a genial attitude on the surface, which cloaked the intent of his words. So Mrs. Glover simply replied, "If he is what you say, he is harmless. And with our experience, that is a great consideration." By the end of the year, Kennedy and Wright were conspiring together, and Mrs. Glover's metaphysical work was beginning to reveal the crimes being committed against her and to expose the criminals. She wrote, "One day we heard them, Kennedy and Wright, plotting to injure us, and opening the door suddenly on them, said, 'We have overheard the conversation of these conspirators.' They arose and blandly looking us in the face, one after the other, declared we were mistaken, and they entertained the highest respect for us." Their lies were followed by Wright's letter to the Lynn Transcript of January 13th, entitled "Moral Science, Alias Mesmerism," which was a lengthy attack on Mrs. Glover and her science. Mrs. Glover replied in the same newspaper the following week, and Wright continued the attack with further letters, claiming that Mrs. Glover taught mesmerism. After several letters over as many weeks, Wright ended by saying that Mrs. Glover and her science were virtually dead and buried. Beginning the book. "And thou shalt go even to Babylon. There shalt thou be delivered. There the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies." Micah. In the heat of the controversy, there was great progress. Mrs. Glover turned to her Bible for guidance one morning and opened to Isaiah 30, verse 8. From that moment, her one main purpose was her book, for God had said to her through Isaiah, "Now go, write it before them in a table, and note it in a book, that it may be for the time to come, forever and ever." She was in the sixth year of practicing and teaching since her discovery, and the child in her womb was no longer embryonic. Her practice and experiments had proved the truth of her theory, and her fidelity to God was beginning to unravel the mysterious occurrences of recent months. She has recorded that she could not have written Science and Health sooner than she did. Her eyes had to be opened to malicious malpractice. Her education through experience was increasing her understanding every day. It would be 3 more years before the birth of her babe that would be for the time to come, forever and ever. But the 9 pregnant years were necessary for the full and proper development of the infant idea. How well she understood this process when she told her students in 1904, "We understand best that which begins in ourselves and by education brightens into birth." Mary wrote in her notebook, "Commenced writing The Science of Life in February 1872. This was the great forward step, but there were other benefits ensuing from this battle early in this new year. Mary had endeavored to meet the evil she had glimpsed in Kennedy's character in the same way she had treated sickness, but it had been totally ineffective. She had learned that the sick can be comforted, but the sinner must be challenged. So she confronted Richard with his sins. Of this, she said, a stolid moral sense, great want of spiritual sentiment, restless ambition and envy, embedded in the soil of this student's nature, metaphysics brought to the surface, and he refused to give them up, choosing darkness rather than light. Carefully veiling his character through unsurpassed secretiveness, he wore the mask of innocence and youth. But he was young only in years. A marvelous plotter, dark and designing, he was constantly surprising us, and we half shut our eyes to avoid the pain of discovery, while we struggled with the gigantic evil of his character, but failed to destroy it. The second year of his practice, when we discovered he was malpracticing and told him so, he avowed his intention to do whatever he chose with his mental power, spurning a Christian life and exulting in the absence of moral restraint. Kennedy's malpractice had brought the searchlight of soul upon mesmerism, and she now saw it clearly. She understood for the first time that Quimby's practice had been benevolent mesmerism, and that any manipulation was an avenue for malicious mind. She lost not one minute in instructing all her students to delete the one short passage from their manuscripts that permitted manipulation. But she lost many of her students over this issue, and first and foremost, among the dissenters was Richard Kennedy. In the midst of Wright's attacks in the newspaper, Mrs. Glover received a letter from Daniel Spofford in Knoxville, written on the 20th of January. "I have for a long time had a desire to write to you on matters relating to science. It seems as though I too should be in the good work. Although I am in business at present, such may not always be the case. I would prefer to feel that I was doing some good and striving to advance the truth. What I wish is that I might be sufficiently taught to at least attend to all of the outside patients wherever we may be situated. Mrs. Spofford is having wonderful success and has recently completed cures that had been given up by the MDs. I think she meets with success in 19 cases out of 20. When W.W. Wright says we meet with but little success, he lied, for he should have said I, and told the reasons, which were primarily that he was practicing mesmerism." There was one disturbing note in Mr. Spofford's letter, and that was the request that his wife should not be informed regarding his application for class instruction. Mrs. Glover sent her response to Mrs. Spofford. Mrs. Glover never broke with her students who were malpracticing, but endeavored always to exhort, instruct, advise, guide. As she wrote to Sarah Bagley, Nearly all my time I have done little else than try to change this vile nature in them, and to sustain them and the cause. But Richard Kennedy would not be guided, nor sustained. Early in March, he refused to pay another cent and tore up his contract. Mrs. Glover went to Peabody to stay temporarily with a new student, Peter Sims and his wife, and it appears that she visited several other places, including Swampscott, before returning to Lynn. Richard spent his time alienating all of her students. During this time, she wrote to Samuel Bancroft. Tuesday, M. Dr. Bancroft, dear student, by which sacred name I call you, thou art near, and yet some considerable distance away, which meaneth, and yet so far. I shall write even though I have not much to say. And do you ask why is this? I answer because I am a fish out of water when I am dragged away from wisdom and love into the grosser abyss of folly and hate. Then I am not a fish at home. Truth is, I am so tried by the malice of my students that up to this time, or a little prior to it, I have done nothing but love and praise that I am losing my happiness and consequently my health. In the dark labyrinth into which I gaze and stand upon the brink, thinking momently, will my students plunge therein? Yes, Mr. Bancroft, they have taken even this step of late. If you call, I will tell you about it. Please call tomorrow, Wednesday evening, and I will be here. Soul and body are one in science. Only we are the soul. This I have just learned, but how can I make you see a demonstration that you can't give? Oh, how I have worked, pondered, and constantly imparted my discoveries to this wicked boy that I shall not name, and all for what? God grant me patience. Mrs. Susie Oliver told me once, Richard said he thought I had suffered so much from bad students. If he did not, well, it would kill me. But it won't. I most fear it will ruin my sweet disposition. I may as well jest over the absurd striplings that turn to rend me, to threaten me with disgrace and imprisonment, for giving to them a discovery that money cannot pay for, but a little good breeding might have helped, at least, to reward the toil, and scorn and obscurity by which it was won for them. Adieu, Mary. Give my teacherly love to Mr. S. P. Bancroft as one of the good ones so far. In spite of her trials, Mary had managed to complete the first 60 pages of her new manuscript by the time she returned to Lynn a few weeks later. Very shortly thereafter, on the 11th of May, the dissolution of co-partnership between Mrs. Glover and her student Richard Kennedy was published. Richard sought other quarters, while Mary stayed for the time being at the Shepherd Street address. She continued working on her book while Kennedy opened a new office, and with his deceptive geniality and boyishness, worked constantly to separate her students from her and win them all as his patients and staunch supporters. Mrs. Glover had not always attended the class meetings, but now in an effort to keep her students loyal to truth, she had meetings in her rooms, as is evident from this letter to Samuel Putney Bancroft. Friday morn. Dear student, I drop you a line, fearing Mr. Allen may forget, and yet it seems to me he has told you of my class meeting, and something has been said to you that is false and you are not feeling your very best. Come, dear Putney, and tell me if you have aught against me. I have thought from what you once said that you regarded me as an adopted sort of a mother. I am this, the same as ever. If you knew the falsehoods I have heard that I said, and I never thought of saying them, you would put little confidence in the folks over there, or in anyone. Come yourself and wife on Sabbath next, at 4 p.m., to number 2 Shepherd Street. I shall have some that do not belong to our class. I wish you would bring over a letter from the Swampscott Post Office, and let me pay you for the cartage. Enclosed, please hand to Mrs. Currier or Frothingham for my last board there. In haste, M.M.B.G. P.S. I expected to leave when I came to Lynn, but 3 successive circumstances hindered me. I have since seen the wisdom of it. We'll tell you all about it. We have an instrument in the parlor again. The Barry family will be here, and we shall have music from you all. Very shortly, she did leave Lynn, visiting first in Tilton and then with her stepmother in Derry, New Hampshire. When she returned, her loyal students presented her with a beautiful family-sized Bible and a copy of Cruden's Complete Concordance to the Scriptures. Her book was now Mrs. Glover's one concern. She had stopped teaching when she began it, so with no classes and no practicing student with her, she had no need for such large quarters. But she did need peace and quiet for her writing. And write she did for the next 3 years. In retrospect, she wrote of this period. Such a flood tide of truth was lifted upon me at times. It was overwhelming, and I have drawn quick breath as my pen flew on, feeling as it were submerged in the transfiguration of spiritual ideas. But the peace and quiet for such writing was not easily found. In August of 1872, she moved to Mrs. Chadwell's on Shepherd Street, and later in the year she boarded with her student, Miss Dorcas Rawson, and her mother, which was temporarily more satisfactory. But she was pursued and harassed, and at times overwhelmed by the wicked malpractice of Richard Kennedy. Student after student succumbed to his mesmerism, never knowing they were mesmerized. Following is a typical case that Mrs. Eddy recorded. A young lady whom we had restored from hopeless disease to health, he drew to his office, told her she was not restored, and prevailed on her to visit him, and he would remove her remaining difficulties. She was in perfect health, and her mother had said so to us. He treated her 3 times and pronounced her cured. The change was immediately apparent. She grew rapidly ill. Then, by his mesmeric mental treatment, he made her believe that we had caused her relapse. And when her mother sent for us to visit her daughter, she was unwilling to be treated by us. Knowing nothing of what this practitioner had done, we were astounded at the result, but thought no more of it until we heard of her death. This mesmerist held her with his mind, as the serpent holds his victim, until she was dying, and then he stood in a remote part of the room while her friends surrounded her bed, and with her expiring breath she said to them, "Dr. Kennedy did all for me that anyone could." Mrs. Glover had taught her students the power of mind over matter and how to apply it to heal the sick and relieve the suffering, never dreaming that anyone would pervert the principle for evil instead of good. She did not see at once that all the disaffection was traceable to Kennedy, but when she did, she wrote, "The history of one of our young students diverged into a dark channel of its own, whereby the unwise young man reversed our metaphysical method of healing and subverted his mental power, apparently for the purposes of tyranny peculiar to the individual. His motives moved in one groove, the desire to subjugate. A despotic will choked his humanity. The habit of his misapplication of mental power grew on him until it became a secret passion of his to produce a state of mind destructive to health, happiness, or morals. His power to heal failed because of his sins, and if he succeeded with the power of will to remove one disease, it was succeeded by a more malignant one. His mental malpractice has made him a moral leper that would be shunned as the most prolific cause of sickness and sin, did the sick understand the cause of their relapses and protracted treatment, the husband the loss of his wife, and the mother the death of her child, etc. We had not an enemy in the city where we introduced this young student and built him up a practice. He commenced his malpractice, or demonology, and then among the many patients that we procured and healed for him, not one, to our knowledge, remained our friend after they were subject to his silent influence." While the flood tides of truth were pouring into Mrs. Glover's consciousness, on the one hand, the awfulness of evil was constantly at its heels. In speaking of this experience, she told us that she walked the floor for 3 days and nights, with the perspiration pouring from her, wrote a student of her divinity course of later years. But she was also able to tell later students that when these experiences cease to bless, they will cease to occur. From the first, Mrs. Glover was guided in her work by visions. A few that she told to students have been recorded, though not always in detail or specifically. The first visions were always of water, and in proportion as I would walk over the wave or struggle through it with an old rickety bark, and the waters subside, would be the success of our cause. Then came in an interval of serpents. Then it went back to water again. Then came all manner of beasts. Mrs. Glover's early students looked upon her teachings as a method of healing for the purpose of regaining their health or of entering upon a business venture, though her religious and moral views were always foremost. She followed her class instruction with precept upon precept, that they might learn that continued success depended upon the purity of their own lives. After Richard Kennedy's divergence into mesmerism, with no moral demands, one after another dropped away or turned against her. She had a vision at this time in 1872 that strengthened her in her work. "I was pitched out of a boat into the sea and went down. While going down, a clear consciousness came to me that I could have no human aid and must go to the bottom. When I reached the bottom, out of the depths, he called me. The view was terrific. Green slime covered it, and the most horrible reptiles hissed around me. But immediately a ray of light came down through the water, and there burst in upon me the most gorgeous sunlight, and there was no more sea. 1873 found Mrs. Glover moving from boarding house to boarding house, living with one student and another. The one student who was most helpful was young George Berry. He spent many hours house hunting, helped her with her moving, ran errands, and most important of all, devoted himself to copying her manuscript. George was not aware of it, but Mrs. Glover made out a will, leaving all her estate to that young man. In mid-73, Mary was back in Mrs. Clark's boarding house on Summer Street, where she had lived the first time with Daniel Patterson in the summer of 1866. After several more weeks of industrious writing, she had her manuscript ready to present to a publisher. George Clark, too, wanted a publisher, for he had written a sea story for boys. So one day in the fall, he accompanied Mrs. Glover to Adams & Company on Bromfield Street in Boston. George was jubilant on the way home, for his story had been accepted for publication, and Mrs. Glover rejoiced with him, speaking encouragingly about his future. But her science of life had been rejected, for the publisher could see no possibility for profit in it. George Clark accompanied Mrs. Glover on another fall day in 1873. This time it was to a courtroom in Salem on the 4th of November. It had been 7 years since Daniel Patterson had deserted his wife, when they had been residing at Mrs. Clark's boarding house, and she now made the separation legal and permanent with a bill of divorcement. Mrs. Glover renewed her efforts on her manuscript, rewriting and revising, and the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. Richard Kennedy followed her every footstep, avidly. The previous year, on September 8, 1872, he had written to Sarah Bagley. Last Friday night, Mrs. G. had a gathering of her students. She has something new on foot this time, or at least she is going to make a new movement. And this is the movement. She intends throwing out great inducements to all those who gather about her in this hour of her peril. She is the center around which all the orbits must revolve, and when one sees fit to step out from her circle, they lose their equipoise and are known no more among men. How fearful to think of! Don't you almost shake with fear and awe at her terrible sublimity? But after all, I ought not to speak of her. She is not worth notice. Perhaps Kennedy did not speak of her often, but he noticed her every move and hounded her every footstep. During the writing of Science and Health, Mrs. Glover moved time and time again, because the wicked thought of the malpractitioner followed her from household to household, stirring the thought of her companions, disturbing the harmony and the peace and quiet, in addition to breaking up her body of students. It was probably November of 1873 that she wrote this letter to Putney Bancroft. Thanksgiving Day. Friend Bancroft, they tell me this day is set apart for festivities and rejoicing. but I have no evidence of this except the proclamation and gathering together of those who love one another. I am alone today and shall probably not see a single student. Family ties are broken, never to be reunited in this world with me. But what of those who have learned with me the truth of moral science? Where do they find their joys? Where do they seek friendship and happiness? Shall I see one of them today? Will they love to gather themselves around me to talk of loftier joys and be getting ready to receive them? To talk of a home in heaven where love fills the thoughts and goodwill reaches the finest sense of all the Spirit calls around them? Is one hungry and they feed them, thirsty and they give them drink, naked and they clothe them, sick and they visit them, a stranger and they take them in, or in prison and they come unto them? Years have passed since I have been keeping this law of love in as much as was possible in this wicked world, but now I, in turn, look in vain for others to do to me as I have done unto them. My spirit calls today, but who of all my students hear it? Who of you are thinking of the hungry and the stranger today? Would you give me meat at your boards of turkey? Oh, no, for you would then offend the world by entertaining a guest of God. No, you cannot supply this literally, and this is not my want, but you cannot supply this spiritually. Say you, and this is my want. The literal and spiritual go together. If you did the one to triumph over this world, you would do the other. And inasmuch as ye do it to the least of these little ones, ye do it to truth also. Now, dear student, do you understand me? Do you think I want an invitation to dine out today? Oh, no, you cannot so misconstrue the meaning. But I wish you all were awake in this hour of crucifixion. Awake to the sense of the hour before you and the oil you need in your lamps at that coming of the bridegroom. I regret to inform you our regular class meetings are broken up. If you call on me, I will tell you all I know as the cause of this. May God bless you, my dear student, and hold you lovingly in the paths of his testimony. M.M.B. Glover. In the spring of 1874, Mary was ready to present her manuscript to a publisher once more, and again it was rejected. But she was not deterred. She started revising and rewriting once more. Mrs. Glover said that she had never made a specialty of healing, laboring instead in whatever direction God led her. But she was ever ready to respond to calls for help. One of her students, Mrs. Miranda Rice, called for Mrs. Glover at the birth of her youngest child. Her testimony, which was later published, said in part, "Slight labor pains had commenced before she arrived. She stopped them at once and requested me to call an accoucheur, but to keep him below stairs until after the birth. When the doctor arrived, and while he remained in a lower room, Mrs. Eddy came to my bedside. I asked her how I should lie. She answered, 'It makes no difference how you lie,' and added, 'Now let the child be born.' Immediately the birth took place, and without pain. The doctor was then called into the room to receive the child, and he saw that I had no pain whatever. My sister, Dorcas B. Rawson of Lynn, was present when my babe was born and will testify to the facts as I have stated them. I confess my own astonishment. I did not expect so much, even from Mrs. Eddy, especially as I had suffered before very seriously in childbirth. For several years, I had been troubled with prolapsus uteri, which disappeared entirely after Mrs. Eddy's wonderful demonstration of Christian Science at the birth of my babe. Miranda R. Rice, Lynn, Mass., 1874. A few testimonials were published at one time or another, but scores of Mrs. Glover's healings were never published, and scores more never even recorded. Another mother in Lynn brought her young son, Stanley, to Mrs. Glover, saying that she feared it was too late. The little child had brain fever, and she was afraid he was already gone. Mrs. Glover took the child in her lap and asked the distraught mother to leave and return in an hour. Mrs. Glover turned her thoughts to the truth of being, and after a time became aware that the child was sitting up in her lap, looking into her face. He said, "Me is tick." And Mrs. Glover answered, "No, you are not sick. You are well." He repeated, "Me is tick," angrily, and struggled in her arms, trying to strike her, until she stood him on the floor while she talked to him of truth and love. When he began to sob, she took him in her arms and talked to him tenderly. He was healed of brain fever and perverseness, and even more. Mrs. Glover sent him to answer his mother's knock on the door, and thought for a moment she would have another patient as his mother appeared near collapse in her astonishment. Stanley had been paralyzed from birth and had never walked before. But while these marvelous healings were occurring in Mrs. Glover's presence, the strange occurrences of the past 2 years did not cease. For the record, Mary penned the following. A young lady from Boston who was suffering from ill health and a peculiar grief became our student and recovered her health and happiness. Our friendship flowed smoothly. Nothing ever occurred to interrupt it, but the Argus eye of the mesmerist was on her. He inquired her out thoroughly and learned that we were strongly attached to her. That was enough. One evening, she called on us to present us with a beautiful pair of vases. On leaving, she startled us with the remark, "I shall probably never come to see you again, but shall always love you the same as now." We replied, "That will be a poor proof of it, when we reside so near you." She had no reason for her remark, and claimed none, and we concluded it was merely mirthfulness. We parted with the usual affection, but have never seen her since, and certain unmistakable proofs have convinced us that the aforesaid mesmerist influenced her feelings and action. By summer, Mary had completed her manuscript to her own satisfaction and had it copyrighted on the 7th of July. Shortly thereafter, she was able to make arrangements with a printer to print the book at her expense. In her notebook, she wrote, "September 6th, 1874. Sent my manuscript to the printer to commence work. The work is entitled The Science of Life. It was another year before Science and Health was published, but at this juncture, she thought her labors were behind her and that she could turn her attention in another direction.